This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Janis Joplin took to the stage at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, and through the power of her performance in just a few minutes, she changed the course of rock and roll and American culture. It was a long road that led Janis Joplin to that stage, started in Texas in her hometown in Port Arthur, then to Austin, and then back and forth across the country. In this episode of The Source, we hear from Holly George Warren, author of the book Janis, Her Life and Music. This is Janis Joplin and her breakout performance, Ball and Chain.
Down by my window, just looking out at the rain. Sitting down by my window, just looking out at the rain. Some came along on the grand old man, and it felt like a ball and chain.
Pop Festival was really Janis's big coming out party. The band Big Brother and the Holding Company, of which she was a member, had won quite a bit of fans around the San Francisco Bay Area, but really were not known outside of that small little part of California. So that show at Monterey Pop, Big Brother and the Holding Company, with no special mention of Janis's name, she was just one of the guys at that point, were booked to play Saturday afternoon, not the most exciting slot. But once they hit that stage and Janis opened her mouth to sing, the audience just went nuts. And they had done a great PR job, the promoters of that festival. It was really the first, you know, rock festival. And lots of critics from all over the country were there, and they were just all, you know, as the Brits like to say, gobsmacked when they saw Janis sing. Now, the funny thing is, the San Francisco bands, including Grateful Dead and others, were not so keen on the idea of being filmed at the festival. They didn't trust the promoters. They thought maybe they were being exploited, et cetera. And the great D.A. Pennebaker, known for the Dylan doc Don't Look Back, was the guy in charge of the film crew. He was directing a film, live performances of the festival. So they were not filmed at the festival, Big Brother and the Holding Company, that Saturday afternoon. Pennebaker was livid. He was, I cannot do this film without Janis Joplin in my movie. So the promoters went back to Big Brother and convinced them to sign off on the agreement to be filmed. And so they were given yet another slot. They got to go back out on stage again the next day, on Sunday in the evening, just at around dusk or so. And again, just an amazing performance. By the time they did Ball and Chain, I mean, people were just, you know, everyone was up on their feet and just going nuts. I mean, it was just this amazing performance.
One of my perennial hitchhikes across the country, I ran into a chick in Texas by the name of Janis Joplin. And I heard her sing, and Janis and I hitchhiked to the West Coast. 50 hours it took us, probably the fastest trip across country we ever made. A lot of things have gone down since that time and this, but it gives me a great deal of pride to present today the finished product of 3 or 4 years of work, Big Brother and the Holding Company.
We're down on.
Able to see the performance, we're able to see what Janis, how she presented herself at her coming out party, and she seemed a lot more put together than the Janis Joplin that we typically associate.
Yeah, she was, you know, she was still pretty fresh and frisky and young, and you know, she
I mean, she's wearing really like this golden pants suit type of a thing.
Yeah, she, and even that, though, it kind of gives a little nod to where she would go with her costuming and outfits that would get more and more, out, you know, just really cool, over-the-top, kind of eye-catching outfits that she started having friends and designers make for her. At that point, you know, she already had this idea in mind. I found letters that she had written prior to Monterey Pop where she talked about, I want to get gold lamé and I want to have spangly stuff on stage. And, you know, most of the kind of countercultural look was a little bit more kind of, you know, peasant dressy and dressed down and denims. And she had started out wearing those kind of outfits. But once she started making enough money to kind of emulate some of her big influences like Bessie Smith, who really dressed to the nines on stage, Janis kind of channeled that kind of showbiz idea through her own countercultural bohemian tastes. And, you know, I mean, she was having tops made out of lace tablecloths and things like that already. But she, you know, you can't really tell it too well, but that outfit had little flecks of gold threads kind of going through the kind of cream color of the pantsuit. So she was already starting to head in that direction a little bit. And she, you know, yeah, she hadn't been on the road a lot. She wasn't burned out at all. She was so excited. You could just tell. She's just knows that this is it for her.
Now, when Janis joined Big Brother and the Holding Company, they were already, as you say, established in the San Francisco area. On a combination of the two, you're wondering, why isn't Janis singing more? You know, why is this other guy singing?
The thing about Big Brother and the Holding Company, that band was a democracy. They had formed in 1965. Peter Albin, the bass player, was formed it with Sam Andrew, the guitarist, one of the guitarists. And they had been playing around even the Trips festivals around San Francisco. So they were already getting a bit of a following in that whole kind of crazy dance hall, Avalon ballroom scene that was going on at that point. So when she walked in that door to rehearse for the first time with Big Brother and the Holding Company in June of 1966, she was just going to be just another member of the band. Now, they did specifically want a female singer. Grace Slick was in Great Society at that time. Jefferson Airplane had a female singer, Signe Anderson, who sang with Marty Balin. So they were kind of going for that. Peter Albin had done a lot of the vocals, but Sam Andrews sang some songs, James Gurley sang some songs. And in fact, really for that first period of almost a year, Janis was just one of the guys. Maybe she would sing four or five, six songs, and then the guys would sing songs. They would all contribute songs. It was one of those all for, you know, one and one for all kind of deals. Now, what happened was, after Monterey, that whole dynamic completely changed. Of course, she was already getting an enormous amount of attention from fans at their shows, but after the breakthrough at Monterey Pop and Clive Davis became interested in signing them to Columbia, and of course, the biggest manager in the country of rock and roll, Albert Grossman, who famously managed Bob Dylan, wanted to sign them as his clients. So everybody was focusing on Janis at that point, and that's when things really started to change.
We're taking a break, but first, we heard Janis Joplin singing Ball and Chain earlier. Now here's the original, sung by Big Mama Thornton. Holly George Warren says Janis asked Big Mama if she could also sing it.
Big Mama Thornton was living out on the West Coast at that point. They went to see her perform at a little club there in San Francisco, she and the guys from Big Brother, and were just blown away when they heard her version of Ball and Chain. Janis just started scribbling down the lyrics. She was a quick study. They went backstage to meet Big Mama after the show and said, "Kate, can we cover that song?" And she said, "Yeah, you sure can, but just don't mess it up," although I think she used a different word.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm talking with Holly George Warren about her book, Janis, Her Life and Music. This is Janis Joplin singing about her painful years in Texas and Port Arthur.
I just had to get on the Texas plane. Lord, it was ringing me down.
Rock is this kind of off-the-cuff blues that came together when Janis reunited with her old beloved bandmates, Big Brother and the Holding Company, after it was kind of a bitter breakup, but then luckily they were back friends again in 69, and she joined them for a show in San Francisco, and at that point, Nick Gravanitis, the great blues singer out of Chicago, a songwriter who wrote some of Janis's big songs, was singing lead with the band. So Janis and Nick started doing this blues that was called Ego Rock. And you can hear Janis kind of dissing her old hometown of Port Arthur in Texas in that song. Now, I think deep down, Janis was always a true Texan. Her Texas roots go way back. Her dad's family, you know, there was a sheriff in there, a cowboy who rode, you know, herd, and her mother's family, too, had really far back roots as settlers, frontiers people, etc. And I think Janis kind of, in a way, was like a Texan as far as our mythical West of the individualist and being as fearless as she was.
She would say that she has pioneer stock.
Yes, definitely. She was proud of that. But she kind of ended up focusing on some difficulties she did have in Port Arthur her last couple of years in high school, in which she was the fearless gal who snuck across, you know, the river and went to Louisiana and went to these roadhouses and drank beer and saw all these, you know, incredible bands play and, you know, was listening to R&B music, loved black music. And this was a very segregated time. It was a time when young girls, I mean, she was just a teenager, were not even supposed to be keeping company with guys, you know, barely unchaperoned. And here she was, the only girl in a carload of boys, going out drinking and hearing some crazy music. She even went so far as to borrow, a.k.a. steal her dad's car one night and go to New Orleans to see music there, and that landed her in a lot of hot water. So she became really the talk of the town. People were calling her bad words and shunning her and really treating her horribly.
But simultaneously, she was a star student. Her slide rule is in
I've gotten to see the slide rule. Yeah,
and, at the Port Arthur Museum. I mean, mm-hmm. She was a math whiz and an accomplished student.
Yeah. The interesting thing about Janis that people forget is she was a very good myth maker. She was very good at the sound bite when she gave interviews. So once she got big and was doing interviews, she started focusing on those turbulent last couple of years that she was in high school in Port Arthur and the hard time she was having, how she was shunned and mistreated by everybody. But you know what? The fact is, she grew up in a very loving home, and she did have lots of friends in her early part of her life. She actually did quite well at school. She won awards for writing. She was a very talented artist. She was doing lots of painting and drawing and was, again, being awarded for that. She was quite popular. So I think the fact that when she went her own way and tried to be a little mini beatnik is what she wanted to be in Port Arthur once she discovered On the Road, the great Kerouac book, when it came out, and started listening to blues and the kind of music that was not really acceptable to listen to by most white residents there in Port Arthur. That's when she was kind of cast aside and treated as this weirdo outsider. But the fact that she lost her status, she lost her popularity, I think is what embittered her so much. I mean, if she had always been kind of the loser, oddball weirdo her whole life, she would be used to it by the time it really amped up in her senior year in high school. So I think it just kind of shows how much it did hurt her when people turned against her and didn't accept her for her free-thinking, freewheeling kind of attitudes and lifestyle. But, you know, those kind of stories about being, you know, used and abused make much better press. You know, the old, if it bleeds, it leads kind of idea. So those are the stories that Janis began telling the press once she was famous, and they were interviewing her and wanting to know how this, you know, girl from Port Arthur, Texas, became the queen of rock and roll.
This is a song called What Good Can Drinking Do? And I wrote one night after drinking myself into a stupor.
How does Janis Joplin get to be the person that you described and become the person who writes and then sings and records this 1962 song in UT Austin, What Good Can Drinking Do?
Janis really thought that she was going to be an artist. She kind of modeled some of her work after Modigliani, who, if you know about him, lived a pretty tortured artist life in Italy. And she went off to college and was still thinking she'd major in art, and that didn't work out too well in Beaumont. So after a few misadventures, her first time hitchhiking to San Francisco, and then she ended up back in Port Arthur. Anyway, she went to Austin, Texas, and found out that, wow, there is this cool scene there. There's people playing the kind of music I'm into, and they're reading the kind of books I'm into. So she talked her parents into letting her enroll at UT Austin. And there she found a real community that supported her music. Now, at this point, she'd only just sung in front of some of her dear friends in Port Arthur. She'd never sung really in public. She may have done a little busking out in California when she was 19 and hitchhiked out there, but not really. So there in Austin, she starts hanging out with this band called the Waller Creek Boys, who were doing mostly kind of folk and a little bit of bluegrass and country. So Janis brings all this blues music into the mix that she had been learning from finding these hard-to-find blues records. She was a real student of the blues. And so they thought she was amazing, of course. They start playing on campus at a place called the Chuck Wagon and just built this huge audience of students. And then they end up playing at this place called Threadgill's, which, thank goodness, still exists, run by a guy named Kenneth Threadgill, who had grown up loving Jimmy Rogers, the blue yodeler, etc. And he really takes Janis under his wing. He just thinks she's terrific. And so she was doing a mix of everything from Rosemadic songs to even, you know, some other kind of like bluegrassy songs to jug band songs, blues. And she starts writing her own songs.
So she's accompanying herself with an auto harp?
Yeah, she learned how to play an auto harp. And she later talked about she never went anywhere in Austin without her auto harp. She always had it with her. They're very portable. She would do harmonies with the guys, Lanny Wiggins and Powell St. John, who were in the band. And Powell was a great harmonica player, so there was usually harmonica on all the songs. You know, at this point, she had discovered Bob Dylan and wanted to start writing songs herself. You know, she was joined to drinking her beer and drinking her wine, mainly, like all the other college students at that time. So What Good Can Drinking Do was, I think, kind of an appropriate song for her to debut as one of her first originals. One of their buddies began recording some of their performances because, again, everybody was just blown away by Janis's voice.
And
Texan took notice of her. They even wrote an article about her. The headline, "She Dares to Be Different."
Yes, and Pat Sharp, the woman who wrote that article, was also 19 years old and is still a journalist, writes for the Texas Monthly, and I got to speak with her, and she had some great stories about Janice and how she was so different, and she, you know, Pat had never seen anyone like her. Again, people were wearing the bouffant hairdos, the gals were wearing shirtwaist dresses and bobby socks and loafers, and Janice was often walking around barefoot. She was really into the beat look then, wore tights with a men's big floppy shirt over the tights, and she was quite different. Of course, her hair was growing long and just hanging down, and she, you know, I think she modeled herself a little bit after, if you can see a picture of Joan Baez at the time, she was on the cover of Time magazine around then, and she's kind of wearing a similar kind of outfit. So that was Janice's look, which was quite different in Austin at that time.
She was also bullied at UT Austin.
Yeah, sadly, even though Janice was just beloved for her singing, she, again, being the bohemian that she was and being, again, fearless, she had boyfriends and she also had girlfriends. And she started spending time with one woman that she became lovers with. This was 1962. I mean, homosexuality was illegal in Texas in 1962. And it turns out this house where Janice hung out, which was nicknamed the ghetto, where all the bohemian types and musicians and artists lived, was actually under surveillance there in Austin by police officers, what people later called narcs, kind of undercover students who were spying on trying to catch them doing illegal activity. So they were under surveillance for illicit sexual activity, for drug use. So she was definitely getting this reputation there. A lot of the students there at the ghetto were very active in trying to desegregate lunch counters in Austin. You know, it was still quite segregated, movie theaters, etc. So that was frowned upon as well. And anyone that was considered a lefty was just assumed to be a communist. And this is still, the blacklist and the Red Scare was still pretty much on everybody's minds. It had not gone away by early 60s. Janice became a point of concern, I think, among some of the authorities, but also those same type of guys who made her life miserable in Port Arthur, Texas, were now making fun of her, and especially when her sexual orientation seemed to be outside the norm, that kind of, I think, really set it off. UT had this kind of funny fundraising thing that fraternities did in that day called the Ugliest Man on Campus Contest, and usually it was the biggest, beefiest, you know, most beat up linebacker or whoever would be nominated, and there would be posters all over campus with the person's face on there, so, and people could vote. And I think you actually had to pay money to nominate people, and that's how the fundraising went. Well, some joker selected Janice as a candidate for Ugliest Man on Campus, and it was just devastating to her. She laughed it off and acted like she didn't care, but according to her sister, she wrote a letter home just very, very upset about it. And it was not too long after that she started getting really burned out on being in Austin and ended up leaving town with another Texan, Chet Helms, just a day after her 20th birthday in January 1963. They set off for San Francisco.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Holly George Warren's book is Janis, Her Life in Music. More when we come back.
Song called Leaving This Morning. Got me rocking and reading notes from the side.
Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. Holly George Warren has written a biography of Janis Joplin called Janis, Her Life and Music.
Janis got out to San Francisco in January of 63, pretty much was a hit right away. She went to like an open mic night in the North Beach area. There was a place called Coffee and Confusion, another one called Coffee Gallery. So again, her voice was undeniable. People immediately recognized her talent, and she started building an audience even then, even though she had nobody to help her. And she started just kind of hitchhiking and making her way to the other areas, to Berkeley, to different towns, Palo Alto, where there was, you know, maybe one coffee house in each town. So she started gradually building a following. But it was a very hard life. She was living hand to mouth. Again, she was like sleeping on people's couches. She ended up in a pretty supportive relationship with a young African-American woman named Jay Whitaker, who was very supportive, and she lived in a house. So Janis lived there for a while. But, you know, again, she was kind of all over the place, Janis, and decided she wanted to check out the New York City folk scene where Bob Dylan had gotten his start. So she ended up going out to New York. She spent most of the summer of 1964 there and really just kind of made her money as a pool shark. She got to be a very good pool player in San Francisco, and then she used that to actually make money in New York City the summer of 64. I was able to track down a couple of shows that she did at folk clubs, but she didn't really pursue it that much. Sadly, what she did get into was speed. And crystal meth or methamphetamine was very prevalent in the East Village of New York at that time, and also in San Francisco in North Beach. A lot of people were using that drug. You know, Janis ended up, by 1965, she was down to 88 pounds. And she was doing nothing but just kind of, she was barely singing anymore. She was pretty much a wreck. And all of her close friends were into it as well. So it was just this pretty horrible situation. So she ended up on a Greyhound bus back to Port Arthur in the early summer of 1965.
So back at Port Arthur, it seems like this is where she makes one more go at being Susie Homemaker.
Yes. Janis, interestingly, during her, when she was bottoming out on speed in 1965, she started spending time with this fella who sadly turned out to be a real con artist, but he was also a speed freak, and he fell in love with her, he said, and wanted to marry her, and they both agreed to get clean, get off speed, and make a life together. So that kind of gave Janis hope. She landed back in Port Arthur, and she was frightened. She knew how close to death she had come. So her family, of course, took her in, nurtured her back to health, and she went back to college, and she tried to be one of those college co-eds that she scoffed at when she was in Austin. She tried wearing the proper clothes and be very studious. She was a commuter student to Lamar Tech in Beaumont and really actually got into it. She wanted to be a sociology major and was doing quite well in school, but what really got her, you know, grounded there was her love affair with this guy who turned out to be just using her and not really interested in wanting to have a life together. But for whatever reason, he thought he could get money out of her parents or something. I don't know. I think he was just nuts. But anyway, she wrote something like 70 letters to this guy over a 3 or 4 month, 5 month time period. And they're so eye-opening to read. You really feel like you see Janis really grappling with this urge to continue to do music, to continue to sing. I mean, she loved music. She loved it. But she was so frightened by the lifestyle that she thought came with it that she was afraid that she would fall back down the rabbit hole again if she started doing music. And her family, of course, particularly her mother, who herself had been quite a musician, a great singer as a young woman herself, told her, you know, forget about music, just, you know, you want to get married and, you know, start a family and the whole white picket fence 1950s kind of idea of middle class life. And Janis bought into that for a while, but she deep down knew that wasn't really her. And she started seeing a psychologist to deal with all these issues that she had. And finally, she did start singing again. She, in fact, started singing in Houston at some coffee houses where Townes Van Zandt was performing, Guy Clark was hanging out there. So she was at the beginning of that great Texas-Houston singer-songwriter scene.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. When we come back, we pick up the story of Janis Joplin with Holly George Warren, author of Janis, Her Life and Music. Stay with us.
If your daddy likes walking, what's 5 miles a day? And if your daddy likes walking, walk 5 miles a day. Then no matter what he wants, babe, he won't go far away.
I ain't no problem. Yeah.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Holly George Warren's book is Janis, Her Life and Music. In 1967, Janis Joplin is in the band Big Brother in the Holding Company and becomes a star.
Janis and Big Brother and the Holding Company were really like a family. By, I would say, the end of 67, they were looking, you know, to sign a deal with Albert Grossman, who was going to take them to a whole nother level. And they knew that fame was at their fingertips. And Janis was really the only one that all along really, really wanted to be famous. She had a lot of ambition, and she worked very, very hard to attain that goal. The guys in the band, I think, some of them were a little half-hearted about it. And, you know, you have to understand the countercultural ideals of that time, and they were very much part of that whole Summer of Love kind of vibe in San Francisco, was anti-fame, anti-money, you know, anti-commercial. But Janis, really, since, you know, back going back to when she was in Austin, you know, she could taste it. She wanted it. And her parents had always instilled in her to try to make something of herself, to work hard to achieve her goals. And she saw this becoming a famous singer, that was her goal. She wanted to make money. She wanted to be famous.
Okay, there was no roadmap for a woman to become superstar, famous, rock and roll in America. No one had ever really done that before.
That is correct. Janis was the original rock star.
So what did she think she was doing? How did she think she was going to get there? What did fame look like to her before she achieved it?
Fame to her was what she saw on the Ed Sullivan Show growing up in Port Arthur. First she saw Elvis Presley, and she saw that kind of fandom. She saw the effect he had on audiences. Then in the 1960s, in 1964, 65, she saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. She saw the kind of attention and fame that they got and audiences going wild for them. And by 1966, 67, when rock was becoming the major form of entertainment for what the people we now call the baby boomers, they had the numbers. They had the audience, and they you know, it was music was transitioning from a singles-driven economy of AM radio. It was transitioning to an album economy and FM radio. So more money was definitely going to be made. Artists could see that they could have more longevity because early on, yeah, the whole idea was kind of flash in a pan, you know, pop star for a couple of years on AM radio and then goodbye, you forget about them. So there was a new paradigm, and Janice saw that and she wanted to be part of it. There was beginning to be music magazines, Rolling Stone started. There hadn't been much of an infrastructure, but now by moving into the late 60s, there was music magazines to write about the artist, to again spread the word, more radio stations, FM stations starting to happen to play that kind of music. There was a way to become kind of a countercultural version of Elvis, and I think that's what Janis wanted.
The mythology of Janis Joplin is that she achieves this level of fame and she finds it to be that it makes her miserable. Is that true?
Well, I think that is a mythology. I think that it's a fallacy that Janis was a victim and that she was always suffering and always unhappy. And I tried to talk to as many people as I could that knew Janis, that hung out with her, because of course, we all have bad days and we all have disappointments, but I think it became kind of Janice's, again, her persona, her kind of public creation, that she was like that all the time because she was singing the blues. But in reality, she, you know, she did have some dark periods. She definitely had things dogging her, and she had a tendency towards depression. But I think she also had a lot of joyousness. She had this lust for life. She wanted to have all these adventures. And so I think that part of her gets a little bit lost. She was a bookworm. She, you know, just like she was always educating herself about music and the blues, she did the same thing. She was always reading books, just like her dad had.
Did she have any inclination that she was also a standard bearer, that she was breaking new ground for women?
Janis, it's a very interesting time because she saw the effect she had on all those women and all those girls in her audiences, and a lot of them would run up to her after her show. She was very accessible and say, Janis, you know, you're singing for me. You're singing the kind of things that I feel, but I don't know how to say. And I think she really loved that. She would try to help young women who were lost, et cetera, that she crossed paths with, really on a one-on-one kind of basis. However, interestingly enough, by 1970, with the women's movement really starting to happen, starting to gel, feminism, you know, the women's libbers, as they called it, she was actually attacked by some for not being, you know, more outspoken about women's rights. Or, you know, there was an interview that was done literally 3 days before she died in 1970 by Howard Smith, and he said, some of the women's lib people say that, you know, you're too sexual, which, and that you, you know, don't have women in your band. And so Janis was pretty upset, like, she's, you know, hey, I wouldn't settle for a typical girl's role in life. I'm doing all the things that they say they want. I'm living that life. How can they criticize me for that?
What about the community of other rock stars? How did they accept her? It seems like Mick Jagger wasn't really willing to accept her. Why wasn't she accepted into that sphere?
It's very interesting. Janis had some very close friends who loved her music, who became some of the biggest icons of rock. You know, Jerry Garcia, if you see them together, there's some footage of them on the Festival Express tour in 1970, this train tour that Janis was on with the Dead and the band. And she's sitting there playing with Jerry Garcia and Bob Weir and Rick Danko. And they're just so tight. And they have such a bond from, you know, really coming up, she and Jerry, from that early folk scene in the, you know, 1963-64. And then she was very, very tight with Jimi Hendrix. They totally dug each other. They both made it in America thanks to Monterey Pop. And there were a lot of artists that she was very tight with. However, there were some naysayers. You know, the one and only time she played in Europe and the UK in 1969, which I find really rich, Mick Jagger sniffed, well, if I went to see the blues, you know, I'll go see a black artist, which I think that's pretty funny statement coming from Mick Jagger, who, of course, famously started out doing, you know, singing black music. But most of the musicians I talked to, especially those also who actually had the good fortune to see her when they were thinking about pursuing music. Stevie Nicks, for example, had a band that opened for Janis in San Francisco, and when she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame earlier this year, she name-checked Janis, and how seeing her incredible connection with her audiences is what inspired her to do, Stevie Nicks, to do what she did with her life. And, you know, other people too, Kate Pearson from the B-52s, and even, you know, new generations. Alicia Keys has name-checked Janis as being a big influence. Again, just the way that she was able to channel emotion and really just put it all out there when she was on stage singing and on her recordings too.
I wonder about Amy Winehouse and if there was some sort of connective tissue between the two there.
There's some interesting comparisons I think you can make between Amy Winehouse and Janis. Amy was a huge Billie Holiday fan and really sought out jazz and started out as a jazz singer, wanting to be a jazz singer when she was quite young, just like Janis wanted to be the next Bessie Smith and sought out the blues. So I think both of them ended up kind of forging their own style, but they both had these early influences that were very important to them. So I think, you know, you can see some parallels there. And of course, horribly, the worst parallel was that they both died at age 27.
October 4th, 1970, Janis Joplin dies of a heroin overdose. Holly George Warren is the author of the book Janis, Her Life in Music. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.